given a talk on can creation meet the challenge of the fossil record, but it would be antithetical to this, so I thought it'd be kind of fun to lay out some of the issues that you have to confront if you are an evolutionist, because sometimes we think all the data is on their side. So I'd like to put these challenges out to the evolutionists. And by the way, I give these talks at secular universities, the University of Florida I talked at a couple of years ago, and Texas A&M, and a number of universities in Europe. And I present the same thing to them. These are the challenges for you to confront. So I have no apology for dealing with it in that way. So let's take a look then at some aspects of this. There we go. We're going to look at four things as we have time today. Molecular biology and the origin of complexity. This is a part of a talk that I gave last time I was here. But I want to just give you a sense of what evolution is asking us to believe so that you will be able to evaluate whether evolution is capable of answering the challenge. So what I'm going to do is posit the question, can evolution explain what we see inside the cell? Now, I have a PhD in molecular biology. I have not been an active molecular biologist for many years because I'm doing geology, but I have a PhD in molecular biology, so I can speak to it with some authority, not as much as if I were currently doing research there, but I do know a little bit about it. So when I talk about molecular biology, I'm doing it with some sense of an understanding of what's going on here. So we're going to go look inside the cell, and I'm going to show you a video, part of a video, that was produced for Harvard University. So this is for, just like you're a student at Harvard, you're going to see what students at Harvard learn in their classes in molecular biology, and don't be challenged by that, be amazed by it, because this animation was produced by Howard Hughes Medical Institute for Harvard University. It is as accurate as anything we can do in this way. But remember, this is an animation. It's not a microscope looking inside the cell. It's a presentation with the most careful data that we have. It's going to show a white blood cell. And the white blood cell is rolling along the endothelial lining of one of your vessels, and it comes to an area where there's an infection. Now, how does it know there's an infection? And what happens when it senses there's an infection? So we're going to see how that whole process takes place at the molecular level, looking inside the cell. And I want you to be thinking, as you watch it, can evolution explain what we see? Now remember, evolution says there is no God, no creator, no designer, no source of information. There's just dirt. Basically, evolutionists ask us to believe that life came from non-living material, so-called pre-biological soup. And somehow life came out of that and it has emerged. The things that you're going to see in this video are present in all living cells today, all eukaryotic cells, as cells with nuclei, like in our bodies. So that means they had to be there on the earth before there was any other life forms, before we have any fossils. This all had to be there in order to be in the first organisms that show up in the fossil record. So the complexity you see is not something that has changed since the very first organisms we find in the fossil record. So this is a challenge then for an evolutionist to tell us how this could have emerged from non-living material. You ready? Okay, let's see if we can watch this video. And the sound should be on so that we can hear the narration, if you can get it. Here you see the white blood cells rolling along the endothelial lining. And these molecules are interacting with one another, the P-selectins, and that's what pulls the white blood cell along as it moves. And then they let go. as it rolls along. So they attach and then they let go. This is the outer skeleton of the cell. You can see that it is very complex. It's made up of proteins. And this is present on the outside of all cells. It protects the membrane of the cell.
The outer leaflet of the lipid bilayer is enriched in sphingolipids and phosphatidylcholine. Sphingolipid-rich rafts raised above the rest of the leaflet recruit specific membrane proteins. Raft's rigidity is caused by the tight packing of cholesterol molecules against the straight sphingolipids hydrocarbon chains. Outside the rafts, kinks in unsaturated hydrocarbon chains and lower cholesterol concentration result in increased fluidity. At sites of inflammation, secreted chemokines bound to heparin sulfate proteoglycan on endothelial cells are presented to leukocyte 7 transmembrane receptors. The binding stimulates leukocytes and triggers an intracellular cascade of signaling reactions. The inner leaflet of the bilayer has a very different composition than
now
that of the outer
leaflet. Now we're inside the cell.
While some proteins traverse the membrane, others are either anchored into the inner leaflet by covalently attached fatty acid chains or are recruited through non-covalent interactions with membrane proteins. The membrane-bound protein complexes are critical for the transmission of signals across the plasma membrane. Beneath the lipid bilayer, spectrin tetramers arranged into a hexagonal network are anchored by membrane proteins. This network forms the membrane skeleton that contributes to membrane stability and membrane protein distribution. The cytoskeleton is comprised of networks of filamentous proteins that are responsible for the spatial organization of cytosolic components. Inside microvilli, actin filaments form tight parallel bundles, which are stabilized by cross-linking proteins. While deeper in the cytosol, the actin network adopts a gel-like structure, stabilized by a variety of actin-binding proteins. Filaments, capped at their minus ends by a protein complex, grow away from the plasma membrane by the addition of actin monomers to their plus end. The actin network is a very dynamic structure, with continuous directional polymerization and disassembly. Severing proteins induce kinks in the filament and lead to the formation of short fragments that rapidly depolymerize or give rise to new filaments. The cytoskeleton includes a network of microtubules created by the lateral association of protofilaments, formed by the polymerization of tubulin dimers. While the plus ends of some microtubules extend toward the plasma membrane, proteins stabilize the curved conformation of protofilaments from other microtubules, causing their rapid plus end depolymerization. Microtubules provide tracks along which membrane-bound vesicles travel to and from the plasma membrane. The directional movement of these cargo vesicles is due to a family of motor proteins linking vesicles and microtubules. Membrane-bound organelles like mitochondria are loosely trapped by the cytoskeleton. Mitochondria change shape continuously, and their orientation is partly dictated by their interaction with microtubules. All the microtubules originate from the centrosome, a discrete fibrous structure containing two orthogonal centrioles and located near the cell nucleus. Pores in the nuclear envelope allow the import of particles containing mRNA and proteins into the cytosol. Here, free ribosomes translate the mRNA molecules into proteins. Some of these proteins will reside in the cytosol. Others will associate with specialized cytosolic proteins and be imported into mitochondria or other organelles. The synthesis of cell-secreted and integral membrane proteins is initiated by free ribosomes, which then dock to protein translocators at the surface of the endoplasmic reticulum. Nascent proteins pass through an aqueous pore in the translocator. Cell-secreted proteins accumulate in the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum, while integral membrane proteins become embedded in the endoplasmic reticulum membrane. Proteins are transported from the endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi apparatus by vesicles traveling along the microtubules. Protein glycosylation, initiated in the endoplasmic reticulum, is completed inside the lumen of the Golgi apparatus. Fully glycosylated proteins are transported from the Golgi apparatus to the plasma membrane. When a vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, proteins contained in the vesicle's lumen are secreted, and proteins embedded in the vesicle's membrane diffuse in the cell membrane. At sites of inflammation, chemokines secreted by endothelial cells bind to the extracellular domains of G-protein-coupled membrane receptors. This binding causes a conformational change in the cytosolic portion of the receptor and the consequent activation of a subunit of the G-protein. The activation of the G-protein subunit triggers a cascade of protein activation, which in turn leads to the activation and clustering of integrins inside lipid rafts. A dramatic conformational change occurs in the extracellular domain of the activated integrins. This now allows for their interaction with ICAM proteins displayed at the surface of the endothelial cells. These strong interactions immobilize the rolling leukocyte at the site of inflammation. Additional signaling events cause a profound reorganization of the cytoskeleton, resulting in the spreading of one edge of the leukocyte. The leading edge of the leukocyte inserts itself between endothelial cells, and the leukocyte migrates through the blood vessel wall into the inflamed tissue. Rolling, activation, adhesion, and transendothelial migration are the four steps of a process called leukocyte extravasation.
All right. Interesting. Now, if you look at the fossil record, you know that as you go down in the fossil record, you see different kinds of organisms. And you can go all the way until you get to the place in the fossil record where there are no more organisms, no more complex metazoan organisms. And you look at the very first forms you find, they already have all of this complexity in them. So where, to the evolutionist, where did all this complexity come from? It's in every cell of every organism, every eukaryotic organism. Eukaryotic means organism that has a nucleus in it, discrete nucleus. The other kinds of organisms are bacteria or bacteria-like things. And so that's everything around us that we can see has these same processes going on in it. Where did all that complexity come from, if you believe in evolution? All the complexity of modern organisms was present from the beginning of the fossil record at the very, very bottom at the Cambrian-Precambrian boundary. There is no proposed mechanism for the origin of complexity that can stand up to any kind of careful scrutiny. This is not something we're making up. When I present this at secular campuses, nobody stands up and says, oh, no, we understand that. We can explain that. They just sit there in silence. And there is no one single example even of how you can make a single protein without a designer that will carry out some function. There's not even one example, and there are 100,000 proteins in our bodies. And we can't even explain how one of them could have happened without a designer, by accident. So how can evolutionists stand on the assertion that all this happened by accident? People, this is designed. This works. If you even go in and mess up one of those processes, you're going to pay a heavy price for it. It all has to work. And in order to work, it has to work together. And in working together, it eviscerates the idea that life could have originated without a designer. So that's the first issue that I wanted to present to you this morning. Let's go on to the second, genetics. This is all new stuff. It's all stuff that has come on the scene since the year 2000 or so, when the Human Genome Project was completed, and we first realized that the human genome was a lot simpler than we thought. We thought genes did everything. We had the idea that if we could understand what all the genes did, we would understand life. And we found out, to our amazement, that instead of 100,000 genes, there were only 20,000 genes in the human genome. It was much smaller than we anticipated. Only 20,000 genes. Yet we had 100,000 proteins. How can you get 100,000 proteins from 20,000 genes if each gene makes only one protein? Well, it turns out each gene doesn't make one protein. Many genes make many different proteins. In fact, there's one gene that makes 32,000 proteins. One gene. And I'll show you how that happens in just a minute. But you have to realize that if you're going to make more than one protein from one gene, you have to have some way of talking to that gene to tell it which protein you want, right? If I have a vending machine and I put a quarter, or whatever it takes today, into the machine and push a button, or you'll get nothing out, right? And you have to choose which button you want to push. So that's the same thing here. You have to have a control mechanism to govern the development of genes. Well, that's something we didn't know about prior to the Human Genome Project. And that's going to require sophistication that we have no mechanism to explain. So right off the bat, the Human Genome Project told us something's wrong with the idea of evolution. Something seriously wrong. We'll watch this video of how RNA splicing takes place, and it'll help you understand what's
going on. As DNA is transcribed into RNA, it needs to be edited to remove non-coding regions or introns shown in green. This editing process is called splicing, which involves removing the introns, leaving only the yellow protein coding regions called exons. RNA splicing begins with assembly of helper proteins at the intron-exon borders. These splicing factors act as beacons to guide small nuclear riboproteins to form a splicing machine called the spliceosome. The animation is showing this happening in real time. The spliceosome then brings the exons on either side of the intron very close together, ready to be cut. One end of the intron is cut and folded back on itself to join and form a loop. The spliceosome then cuts the RNA to release the loop and join the two exons together. The edited RNA and intron are released and the spliceosome disassembles. This process is repeated for every intron in the RNA. Numerous spliceosomes, shown here in purple, assemble along the RNA. Each spliceosome removes one intron, releasing the loop before disassembling. In this example, three introns are removed from the RNA to leave the complete instructions for a protein.
So what you've seen here is how a process that we didn't understand before we went to the Human Genome Project, we didn't understand why these regions were cut out of the RNA molecule. One gene produces one messenger RNA. That messenger RNA is then edited by cutting out pieces and splicing the other pieces together, and that's how we can make many different proteins from the same gene. And for example, just to give you one more example, there is a protein in your ear that's responsible for you being able to hear various frequencies. And that protein is a calcium channel protein that opens up membranes and allows calcium to move in and out of the cells in your inner ear. There are 980 possible isoforms from one gene. So here you have one region of DNA that makes one messenger RNA that can be edited in 980 different ways. And as you move along the cochlea in your inner ear and you look at the hair cells, you'll find out that it produces different isoforms in each of the cell, different mixes of isoforms in each of the cells along the length of the cochlea, and that's why you hear different frequencies. So this has a real application in our life. We can understand something we can never understand before, how these cells are receptive to different frequencies as you move along the length of the cochlea. So that's impressive, isn't it? That all that complexity is there inside the genes. So not just do you have to worry about how to get genes, and as I mentioned, we don't have reason to think even one gene could ever come into the time that the universe has been here. But given that the genes are there, we have these complex changes that take place in the genes to make the product that we actually need. And that requires levels of sophistication beyond our belief, beyond our understanding. We don't understand what manipulates these genes as they're being processed. We will understand it, presumably. It seems understandable, but it involves standing beyond just the level that we thought we understood before. In fact, as you'll see, genetics is a study of genes, and now we've moved beyond genetics into other areas that I'll mention. After the Human Genome Project was complete and they realized that only 20,000 genes exist in the human genome, it took less than 2% of all the DNA. And as soon as that was realized, that there was DNA in there that wasn't producing genes, immediately the evolutionists said, well, the rest of it's just junk DNA. It's DNA that's trying to evolve into some function. And so the term junk DNA was coined by evolutionists to explain why there was so much DNA when only a little part of that, only less than 2%, was making genes. Remember, our paradigm, our worldview said that the only thing that mattered was genes. And we find out, to our amazement and disturbance, that there's only 2% that's made up of genes. So what's the rest of it? It must be junk in anything. So immediately after the Human Genome Project was finished, the government set up a new project called the ENCODE Project. And the ENCODE Project's job was to find out what the 98% was doing. So they began to develop mechanisms, and this involved over 440 scientists in over 30 labs around the world working on this project to try to decipher the 98% of the DNA and find out its functionality. Well, about 4 years ago, they released their first report. And their first report was shocking to evolutionists, but not surprising at all to those of us who believed in a creator God. What they had found was that so far, over 80% of all the DNA in the genome was doing something. It was carrying out a biochemical function. So far from being junk, we now know that 80% of the DNA is doing something. The evolutionists derided the findings of the ENCODE Project. They got furious. They started trying to find holes in it and tried to figure out ways that all these 440 scientists were wrong, because if you have that level of functionality in the genome, it makes evolution seem vanishingly ridiculous. So that finding was very much disturbing to evolutionists. So you've heard that we're 98% the same as chimpanzees, right? Have you heard that? Our DNA is 98% the same as chimpanzees. Does that bother you? Well, those of us who are scientists were disturbed by that because we're not supposed to be 98% the same. That's almost the same. Well, then we found out, well, we're 95% the same as a mouse, and we're 50% the same as an earthworm. So it didn't leave us very much room to wiggle. But then, remember this. That 98% figure is 98% of the 2% of the DNA. You got that? It's 98% of the 2% that's similar. And then we began to look carefully at what that 2% was doing, what those 20,000 genes were doing. And we found out they're all doing stuff that's the same in every living organism. So no surprise that we have 98% of our genes the same as a chimpanzee. No surprise at all. Because it's only 2% of the DNA, and it's the 98% of the DNA that's making us different from chimpanzees. It's kind of like this. This is a rack in a machine shop full of drawers. Full of drawers, each of which contains different kinds of things that are used in a machine shop. That's like our genes. That's the 20,000 genes. Each one of those is in a drawer in that machine shop. Now, all machine shops have these kinds of drawers or places to put stuff. They might contain a series of drill bits. They might contain nuts or bolts or washers or the kinds of things that machine shops use. And they're organized into drawers so that they can find them when they want them. So here's all these genes that are the same in a chimpanzee and a human. They're like nuts and bolts and things like that in a machine shop. Nothing happens in a machine shop until you have a plan and you have a machinist. And the plan and the machinist are what determine whether you're a human being or a chimpanzee. Isn't that amazing? It's so simple and straightforward, and yet it was overlooked for so long. So here's a plan, a blueprint, and here's machinists working in a machine shop. I think it's probably a wood shop, but it was a picture I found. So here they are. They're putting together things according to the blueprint to make some product that they already know in advance. So the 2% of the DNA is like the drawers in the machine shop. Really important stuff. And if you have a mutation in one of those genes, it's going to affect you because the machinist comes to the drawer and pulls it out and it's empty or it has the wrong part in it. He can't make the product that he's trying to make. So they're really important. But they're only important at the base level because it takes the machine shop and the blueprint to make the product. And the machine shop and the blueprint are the 98% of the DNA. That's what the ENCODE project taught us. So where does that leave evolution? Not trying to explain how we got a gene, but trying to explain how the information on how to use that gene got in there. That's where the evolution is left. A second revolution has happened in the last 20 years or so. It's become more prevalent in the last 5 years. And that's called epigenetics. Now, genetics refers to the DNA and the genes that we talked about that make the proteins that make us, make our bodies up. I used to say make us who we are, but that's not the genes that do that. That's the 98% that we talked about. So the ENCODE project teaches us that we need a lot more levels of complexity than just genes. So the evolutionists are down here worrying about how to make genes. We're thinking about how amazing it is that these genes function together to make a human being. And the same genes function to make a chimpanzee or a mouse or a worm. So now epigenetics is going beyond that. Epigenetics is the marking of DNA with little, actually not DNA, but proteins in the chromosome, marking them with methyl groups to leave a certain message chromosome. And epigenetics are being studied very thoroughly. My daughter, when she did a fellowship in pathology, she went to University of Washington, where she studied with a lady that was specializing in epigenetics. So she spent her whole year studying about epigenetics and its role in cancer. And so it's something that's really important. Now, I have to teach you about Lamarckism first so that you'll understand how remarkable this revolution is. Lamarck said that a giraffe got a long neck because it reached for higher leaves. The will to do something made a difference in the organism. Now, that was way back before the time of Darwin, and before it was about the time of Darwin. It was before we knew anything about genes. Lamarck saw that some animals had different characteristics that led to their survival, he said. So he said giraffes got long necks because they reached for higher leaves. And, of course, Darwin came along, and everybody said, oh, that's ridiculous. The genes control everything. You have to evolve a new gene for a longer neck. And that can't have anything to do with your need. It has to do with just random processes. So, then, last year, a year ago, an article was published in Nature. And that article described experiments in which mice were trained to avoid an odor that was pleasant. So when the pleasant odor was presented to the mice, they were shocked. That's not a very nice thing to do, but the results are pretty astonishing. So they learned whenever that odor was presented, they would run and hide. Makes sense. Mice are smarter than we are sometimes. And the article published in Nature, which is the most prestigious journal in the world, and the editorial of that on that article that described the article, because it was so important, they wrote an editorial on it. It was titled, "The Sins of the Father." Where'd that phrase come from? Because they found out when they bred those mice that were trained to avoid an odor they'd never smelled before, when they trained them to avoid that odor, the mice passed that on to their offspring, and their offspring would have that same avoidance reaction. And then they bred those offspring together, and their offspring had the same reaction. And after 3-4 generations, it kind of disseminated and disappeared. So 3 or 4 generations, where's that come from? Where in the Bible? Second commandment. That's right. The sins of the fathers will be visited upon the children to the 3rd and 4th generation of them that hate me. We now have a physical basis for understanding what God was saying. Because our chromosomes are marked up by our behavior. And if you're a man, your chromosomes that you pass on to your progeny are marked up by your behavior, and those genes, those chromosomes, are passed on to your progeny. And your progeny will respond similarly to things that you did. We don't know how deep this is. We only have this one example right now, but it looks like it's going to be a general trend because these markups are all over the chromosomes. This markup process is something that takes place as you live, and it corresponds to a record of your behavior. And that's passed on in your genes. Not in the genes. It's passed on by these epigenetic markers on the outside of the genes. Now, how sophisticated, forgetting the implications of that for us socially and spiritually and every other way, how sophisticated does a process have to be able to tell an offspring to avoid an odor it's never smelled before? How sophisticated does this regulatory mechanism have to be? Amazing. And a third category. So we've talked about the ENCODE project and how it teaches us that the 98% of the DNA is what does everything. It's the blueprint. It's the machinist in the blueprint. We talked about the epigenetic markers that involve levels of sophisticated control that nobody imagined were present before the last few years. And now we're talking about orphan genes. ORFAN is an acronym derived from an acronym, ORF, which means an open reading frame. An open reading frame designates a region of DNA that is a gene. It means that if the message is transcribed, it will produce a protein. So ORF gave us ORF, and then ORFAN is a term that was applied to refer to these types of genes. These are genes that are present in you, but not present in a chimpanzee. They're genes that are present in a honeybee, but not present in a wasp. They're genes that are present in organisms, but are not present in the organisms that are supposed to have given rise to those organisms. So if you have a gene in you that's not present in a chimpanzee, how do you explain that? Presumably, all the genes that we carry in our bodies were derived from genes that were present in a chimpanzee, if you believe in evolution. But there are at least 1,000 open reading frames or orphan genes in humans that are not present in the chimpanzee. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us something really profound. We don't know what all these things are doing. We know that one of them is the gene that makes our brains bigger than a chimpanzee's brain. That gene is not present in a chimpanzee. It's not in a chimpanzee. It's not present at all. Where did it come from? Remember, evolution is a process by slow, gradual change from one form into another. We have 1,000 genes that aren't present at all in the chimpanzee. How do we explain their presence in human beings? Evolution, draw a blank look when you bring up orphan genes. They don't like to talk about orphan genes because orphan genes suggest that evolution is impossible. Orphan genes, the ENCODE project, epigenetics, these terms that have come to us in the last 10 years are indictments of the inadequacies of evolution in molecular biology and genetics that tell us that evolution is a failed theory. But what about the fossil record? What about the fact that we see different forms down lower in the fossil record than we see higher up? Well, I don't have an explanation for all that stuff. I don't. But I can tell you there's some problems in the fossil record for evolutionists, and since we're talking about that today, let's deal with that. Let's talk about the Cambrian explosion. Cambrian explosion occurs at the very lowest levels that have evidence of complex life forms in them. It's called the Cambrian. Below the Cambrian, the Precambrian, we don't find complex life forms like organisms that move around or whatever. We only find those above the Cambrian-Precambrian boundary. So generally, creationists are wont to say that the Cambrian-Precambrian boundary represents the beginning stages of the flood. This is when we started burying organisms. And so that's kind of our perspective on it. But what about evolutionists? Because above that line, we find organisms of every phylum, every major group of organisms are present above the line, immediately above the line. Below the line, there are no metazoan forms. Above the line, we have virtually all forms of organisms from virtually all phyla. We don't have humans there, but we have organisms that have backbones, which is the same group that we belong to. So how can you have basically instantaneous appearance of all these kinds of life form without any predecessors, because evolution teaches us that life evolved over billions of years from non-living material and gradually became more complex. And yet when we look at the fossil record, we see no complex life and all forms of complex life right at that juncture. And I don't mean all forms are there. There are no humans there. There's no rabbit there. But there is a representative of our group of organisms found right above that line. That's a problem for evolution, because it's the opposite of what evolutionists predict. And at a meeting of the Geological Society of America that I attended, there was a special session on hot topics, and the hot topic was the Cambrian-Precambrian boundary. And they talked all around this problem most of the lunchtime. Finally, someone stood up and he says, "Why are you avoiding the real issue? Why are you unwilling to face the problem that the Cambrian-Precambrian boundary represents, which is the sudden appearance of all complex life forms?" And that's a problem for evolution. And finally, there are fossil sequences. Fossil sequences are where evolutionists suggest that one form develops into another form over a long period in the geologic column, and these are evidences for evolution. When you talk to evolutionists about which particular forms they think are the ones that are that exhibit this gradual change, they turn either to the horse sequence or to whales, fossil whales that lost their feet, went into the water. But they never talk about the vast majority of fossil forms for which there is no evolutionary sequence. For example, one prominent evolutionist, a man by the name of Donald Protheroe, who incidentally hates creationists and has given talks three times at one of our colleges in Southern California. Oh, we only have one. Has been invited to their campus to give talks, even though he is the antithesis of a creationist. And incidentally, just as an aside, very often the people that are most adamant objectors to creation were themselves once creationists. It's a fact that you can verify by reading into their lives. Look at Richard Dawkins, for example, and even in the Adventist church, many of the people that are most adamant about not teaching creation were themselves creationists once. They were theologians, many of them. But that aside, Donald Protheroe studied mammals. He was looking at the evolution of mammals. And he studied 160 lineages of mammals that are present in the United States. And he studied them from their first appearance in the fossil record, when they first occurred, the lowest occurrence of that fossil, until it finally disappears from the fossil record up here. And he was looking for evolutionary sequences. He thought, how famous I will be, I'm making this up, how famous I will be if I can find an evolutionary sequence, because nobody else has done that. He studied 160 taxa of mammals in the Southwest. And by his own testimony, he says, in 160 lineages from their first appearance to their last appearance of the fossil record, only one showed any change. And that change was a slight difference in size. So if you have 160 lineages of mammals that you've studied and they don't show any change, where is the evidence for change? So we can put together a sequence for the horse or for the whale, which we discuss in detail but won't. But what about the other millions of taxa where we don't see any change? There's a term that people that study trilobites, you know what trilobites are? Those little organisms that look like pill bugs. They are found low down in the fossil record. They have a term in studying trilobites called cryptogenesis. Because when they study a lineage of trilobites, it goes along in the fossil record with no change. Suddenly there's a line, and that one's gone, and there's some other form there. So how did the trilobite change from this to this? It's called cryptogenesis. Can you dissect that word? Genesis means origin, and crypto means hidden. Means hidden. And Gould and Eldridge produced a theory called punctuated equilibrium. The organism stays the same for a long time, equilibrium. Then suddenly, there's a new organism, and that one's gone. So their theory of evolution was just a description of what they see in the fossil record, which is not what evolution predicts. So as we look at the evidence for evolution, we look objectively at the fossil record, what we see is a lot of evidence that evolution is an impossible theory. And so what do we do? How do we deal with that? Well, as creationists, we say, wow, do we have those kinds of problems with our theory? What kinds of problems do we see? And we'll talk about one of those this afternoon. We're going to talk about geologic time, which is certainly the biggest problem that we have to confront. There are others with the fossil record. For example, we don't really have a model that explains how it is that you get this distribution of fossils all the way around the world that seems to be uniform in the sediments that we think were buried during the flood. We don't have the answers to lots of questions. And you know, the honest and most useful thing to do when you're confronted by someone who challenges you on your belief is to say, I don't know. I don't have an explanation for that. Honesty always buys you more than dishonesty. If I bluster my way through an argument, and by the way, these gray hairs were earned. If I bluster my way through an argument, I'm going to lose. But if I honestly say, you know, I don't have an answer for that, well, that immediately changes the tenor of the conversation. And it moves you, allows you to move to an area like, what about the origin of complexity? What about the origin of life? What about some other area that you can talk to that puts them on the defensive if that's what you want to do? But I just am very happy that I believe in a creator God who gives me an explanatory power for all these things that evolutionists struggle with. We have a little time for questions. If you have something you'd like to unburden or challenge me with, I'd be willing to take your questions. Yes. Yeah. Right. It is a learned behavior, yes. But you don't generally think that learned behaviors can be passed on to your offspring. How do you do that? And the Bible says they are. And that's why this amazing revelation on these mice is so important. Because those mice are marking up their genes in a way that allows the offspring to receive that information. Now, that can be very beneficial. If something's going to give you a shock, then it's probably going to give your offspring a shock. And if you can protect them from that, how much better is that? So that's at our level of understanding today, epigenetics is the attachment of methyl groups, mostly methyl groups, other things as well, to the histone proteins that are associated with the DNA. And this allows genes to be shut off or turned on. Now, just exactly how that would convey information to an offspring, I don't know. Neither is anyone else. That's a mystery for you to study when you get up there. Yes. Epigenetics.
What about progeny? How do you know? And I guess when they conduct the study, they sort of get
Oh, yeah, because they were separated before at birth, before they had any information. Yeah, that's a carefully controlled experiment, and nature is pretty protective of what they publish. So, come to nature, you can, and it's pretty sure that it's going to be real. But, I mean, it still could be wrong. But that's our current state of understanding. And I thought the editorial just told the story so beautifully. The sins of the Father. Yes. The first organism in the fossil record. The Cambrian Precambrian boundary is drawn on the basis of Trichophagus pedens, which is a trace fossil. It's not even a fossil. It's just a worm, a kind of a worm burrow. And really, it's the first set of kind of worm burrow we find in the fossil record. So since there are worm burrows there, it's assumed that there were organisms, and we don't know what they are. And after that, you start finding trilobites. Trilobites are one of the most common fossils found. I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but Trichophagus pedens is the official designated International Stratigraphic Nomenclature Committee manifestation of their study is that Trichophagus pedens determines the boundary. You can talk to me some more afterwards if you want. Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. As far as we know. And if the next generation accepts that and practices that, they will pass that on to their offspring and so on, and it can stay there forever. It's not, again, going back to the machine shop analogy, it's not another drawer, it's another blueprint. It's another machinist. It's not, you don't need to change the drawers. You change which drawers you're using. And that's how this whole thing is controlled. Yes. Right. That's because, what's that? They would have to, the common ancestor would have to have all those genes to explain it. So since the common ancestor had them, then they should be in the chimpanzee and in the human. And since they're not in the chimpanzee, that means they are indeed orphan genes. So it doesn't explain it. And even if it were something that happened after the common ancestor, you have to explain how in 2 million years you can get 1,000 new genes that are functional, including the one that makes our brain big. How do you design that gene? Let's just talk about that for a minute. That's a good question. To make one gene that has a function requires the assembly of anywhere between 100 and 10,000 amino acids, which means you would need to design a piece of DNA with 30,000 bases for the largest or 300 bases for the smallest, plus control regions and so on, let's say 500 bases. There are four different bases, and combining those bases in different ways gives us 4 to the 500th power, different combinations. There's no way in all the time of the universe to get 4 to the 500th power, different processes to take place. In fact, Dembski computed a number called the number of maximum probability, which is the total number of possible things that could have happened with particles in the universe given all of geologic time. And the number is 10 to the 50th power. So any statistic that's greater than 10 to the 50th power cannot happen in the age of the universe, no matter what it is. So since the probability of getting a protein is much greater than that, you can't make even one protein that has a distinctive signature in all the time that we have. So you can talk to me more again afterwards. I think we're out of time. Thank you very much.